Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 21st of December. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Charles Archer.
How is everyone doing? Is everyone ready for Christmas?
We wish you a Merry Christmas.
Oh, don't start with that again, man.
Christmas. Not ready at all.
Happy New Year.
Not ready?
No, ironically, my office is filled with presents because it's locked and it's the only room where children aren't allowed in. So it's just covered with them everywhere. And yet I've bought none myself because I've been busy. So this weekend's going to be fun for me.
So
what about you,
what
Phil?
Ready-ish. I mean, done a bit of shopping. The thing is, the eldest has her birthday mid-December on the 12th. So it's always like her birthday, Christmas, and then the youngest birthday is at the beginning of January. So it's always like trying to mix them all, get all the presents ready, which one's birthday, which one's Christmas. But yeah, all good, mate, to be honest. I'm looking forward to recording all these and then having, like Kev, a bit of time, downtime over Christmas, spend with family, friends, make memories, you know, do all the usual things, overeat as usual. But yeah, all good. And what does somebody get, Charles? What will you be getting for Christmas, or what's on your want list?
I want just a nice bottle of whiskey and some socks. You know, I don't really want for anything. I mean, literally the
proper
only thing.
Dad present, that.
Well, this is the problem, right? Like, I'm just not a very materialistic person, and the things I am materialistic for are really expensive, so you can't ask for them as gifts. Like,
Yeah.
do I want to get a road bike for £3,000? Yeah, 100% I do. Do I want a Lamborghini? Yeah, I would love one. Do I want a much larger house? Probably not, but like, I wouldn't. But the problem is, the things you can put under a tree, I think it's not about how much they cost. It's more, I find that the personalized stuff or something people put a bit of thought into is way more important and way more valuable.
Yeah. Unless it's a kilogram of gold, that would be quite good.
A kilo of gold would be, is that a hint?
I had a delivery this week, probably like you guys, of some more of the nice, the Britannias, 25 Britannias, and some, so also some gold. And I can't believe that the postman brought them just in the pack, like you know what I mean, like just delivered them to the door. I was shocked. I thought it would come in like a UPS truck or something like that, but no, standard Royal Mail, special delivery signed for. Unbelievable.
The thing is, though, is that with like really high value items, paradoxically, often it is more secure to just send it by a normal post because no one's going to look for it and steal it. But the fact that you got it from the Royal Mail at this time of year is extraordinary.
It's
to me.
Yeah.
I'd like to report it as stolen. Unfortunately, no, it's Christmas. It will come in February. Don't you worry about it.
I'll issue a charge back on the card for it, should I?
Yeah, you should do. See what happens.
Yeah. No, I bought some silver and gold yesterday, and I bought some silver and gold today. Yeah, there you go.
It's gone mad, but yeah, we'll talk
Christmas,
more about
Christmas presents. I don't know, what are they? They're things I give, not I get.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think underwear and socks is a good one. My mother gave me £50, and I went and bought underwear from Marks and Spencer's and socks when I was in England.
I was at a wedding a few days ago, and
so I thought you were going to say you're at a wedding the other day and you took your underpants off. Now,
no. And I had the suit, had the shirt, had everything. The one thing I didn't have, weirdly, was just black socks. All seemed to have disappeared. So I went to Marks and Spencer's to buy some. And I've always been a Primark man for socks because I just see no value in spending money. And oh my God, the quality, the thickness of Marks and Spencer cotton. I've moved up in the world. Can't go back now.
Can't go back to Primark.
No.
After that.
Prime Arnie, as they call it. Well, let's have a look at some of the headlines that have dominated on both sides of the Atlantic. In the UK, attention has been on the economy, with inflation coming in softer than expected, keeping pressure on the Bank of England as markets continue to price in rate cuts next year. Sterling has struggled to regain momentum, while policymakers remain cautious about declaring victory on prices. Politically, Westminster has also been focused on longer-term issues around growth, productivity and public services as we head into the final stretch of the year. Internationally, one of the most shocking stories came out of Bondi in Australia, where a violent attack during a public gathering brought global condemnation and renewed debate around extremism, public safety and security at major events. Tributes have poured in, and the incident has prompted political leaders to promise tougher action against hate-driven violence. Shocking scenes from Bondi. I mean, the fact that one thing that stood out about that story is the reaction from the public and how people tackled the gunman. Did you see any of these scenes on social media of people actually fighting and wrestling, and one guy managed to get a gun off him? Ahmed has been hailed the hero of the Bondi Beach attack. Did any comments on that?
Yeah, obviously, if you're going to put yourself in harm's way of a monarchical government, then you're a hero. You deserve to get those plaudits. I think we're going to get now, though, more and more is questions of gun control versus immigration. And those debates in the United States now, but also in Australia, all over the world, are going to get stronger and stronger in 2026, 27, rather than less strong. And what that means for, Western economies, many of whom rely on immigration, or potentially are having very difficult conversations around the concepts of, the right to own a gun versus the right to, for security. It's going to be very difficult, very, very difficult the next couple of years politically to navigate that, because people aren't having rational conversations or centre ground conversations, and most people now, I would imagine politicians, but just people in general, aren't prepared to compromise on anything. So th it's going to be, it's a microcosm of the way people reacted. It was actually very lovely to see that a lot of people came together, but also there's a large number of people trying to use these events to push their own agendas one way or another. And
Yeah.
yeah, that's my thoughts.
Yeah. Kev?
Don't know, it's hard to say, isn't it? It's not nice when somebody just shoots everybody up. I think if you look at it politically and from a jihadist point of view, because that's basically what it is, then it's bloody frightening, you know? In all the Western countries, there are countless jihadist people who want to cause harm to those places and those people. And if the world doesn't wake up, we're just going to see more and more of this.
Yeah. Well, I think it's I think that my fear anyway is that we are quite reactionary across the West. So what will happen is we'll do nothing, we'll do nothing, we'll do nothing, and then when we do take an action, it'll be a significantly more extreme than if we had dealt with the problem in the first place.
Yeah, well,
That's
a lot of these things, as you say, about when you hear about the gunman who survived, the son. He was known again to the authorities for being involved. They'd been to the Philippines to meet people for, I don't know whether it was training, but they said it was effectively an Islamic, it was effectively an ISIS-backed a terrorist attack, as it was claimed. So when they always say they were known to authorities, why are they not acting on these people? So many of these events, they know them.
well, they do, and if you look at El Salvador, for example, how did they deal with the gang violence in El Salvador? New president came in and literally locked up every gang member and every known criminal in the country, and just let and leaving them locked up for life. And in amongst those individuals, there is almost certainly going to be completely innocent people who don't deserve to be in prison for the rest of their life. But now that country is, relatively speaking, significantly safer than it was, and the president is extremely popular. Is that the answer? Do you just say, right, we know that, if you look at London's a good example, the police have said on many occasions there's a few hundred individuals causing most of the petty crime. In a city of millions, why not just deal with that? And the answer is our systems are just not equipped to deal with it. And it doesn't help that across Western nations, all the prisons are overfilled. And then the way the legal system deals with differences in crimes, somebody's putting out a tweet that might be, incredibly offensive, by getting prison for it in the UK now. And yet, really, really horrific crimes might only go a few years, if that. It just seems completely backwards.
The people who are doing most of these things do understand how the democracies work in the West, and they're using them to their ultimate advantage. And that's not going to change. So unless somebody gets radical, and the problem is then it's seen as phobic in some way, if you make this move. And we've become a woke cultures or
But it's it, but
cultures.
like, yeah, but it's going the other way, Kev. This is new with Trump in charge in the US is a good example. But if you look at the AfD, for example, in Germany, or the rise of quote unquote far right in France, or reform in the UK, this is what will happen. The voting will go right wing, seriously right wing, across Western nations, and then the what the outcome will be not ideal, would be my guess. But I think people have had enough because mainstream political parties just are not dealing with the major problems, whether they're economic or societal. So we shall
Well,
see.
on the subject of Trump, I mean, Kev, you posted a really good one on Facebook. Obviously, we saw Trump last night talking, effectively defending his economic record in his public appearance. But I mean, the words were, and I quote, "After 11 months, our border is secure, inflation is stopped, wages are up, prices are down, nation is strong, America is respected, our country is back, stronger than ever before. We are poised for an economic boom like the world has never seen." Comments.
Delusional.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that if you're not living in the United States, you kind of view the stock market as a proxy for living standards, right? You wouldn't know, for example, in the UK, unless you're an investor, the FTSE 100 is at record highs. The FTSE 250 has had a really good year, but the average person's living standards has fallen dramatically. And it's the same in the US. It's just a massive artificial intelligence bubble propping up the Mag 7 and the big tech stocks. But the average lived experience of the average American is, in big, big trouble. And the currency in the US, the dollar, is just, I think it's lost 10% of its value this year. But it's just going to get worse and worse because you're cutting interest rates into inflation. And also quantitative tightening is over. And they've basically re-announced quantitative easing, just but under a different name. So next year, your dollar is going to buy you less and less and less. And then you have tariffs putting up the prices of everything. More rents and mortgages are
Yeah.
unaffordable.
Well, he's just announced 530 billion of quantitative easing, but he's not calling it quantitative
No,
easing.
it's just by any other name. I wrote in an article for the other day. But this is the problem, right? Like you put the rates down, you put the quantitative easing up, you feel good. It's kind of like getting drunk, right? Or taking money out on a credit card. You feel good for a while, but then you're going to have a hangover. And once that money is spent and in the economy, it's zooming around. But the more dollars that you print, the less valuable each dollar becomes. And lo and
Yeah.
behold, this is why gold, silver, platinum, palladium, we're just rocketing, because the US dollar will, in my view, for a very long time, it's going to remain the currency unit. It's how world trade will continue to be conducted. But people won't stay in dollars for a very long time. They'll use it to conduct trade and then be in real assets, hard assets, for the rest of the time. If that makes sense.
Now, we were due Rick Rule on the podcast, but unfortunately, due to extreme weather in Washington State, the power has been out, and there's absolutely no access to any of the internet, so that's not possible. What I'm going to do, though, Charles, if you're all right with it, is I'm going to use some of the questions that I had for Rick based on his last podcast to sort of see if you can answer a few of them. If you're cool
Yeah,
with that.
sure. Yeah,
Okay,
fine, fine. I'll be your fake Rick, no problem.
fake Rick for the day. Yeah,
Yeah. Oh, you'll be my Morty. Let's go, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, last time Rick was on, he was very clear that gold wasn't just a trade for him. It was a savings, protection against what he called a dishonest default through inflation rather than an outright collapse. And since that conversation, obviously, we've seen gold pushing to fresh all-time highs, sitting around the 4,300 mark an ounce, $4,300 an ounce, driven by central bank buy-in, geopolitical stress, and falling confidence in fiat currencies, just as you alluded to there, Charles. That seems to line up almost exactly with his view that gold moves when people start worrying about the system rather than chasing returns. So, looking at what's happened this year, Charles, did you feel the market is finally validating that idea of gold as insurance rather than speculation? Or do you still think that most investors are misunderstanding why they own it?
Well, I think if you look at the allocations fund managers make to gold, it's still virtually nothing by historical standards. Central banks are buying the stuff because, again, the US dollar as a unit of value, as a store of value, is struggling very clearly. I would say the key distinction is the investment risk versus promise risk distinction. And people just, they still confuse this because you talk about gold, it might go, it's worth 4,300, quote unquote. But it's not worth that. It just the demand has gone up from central banks and from retail, and the supply has stayed static or down a little bit. And so, if you're printing loads of dollars and demand has gone up, then obviously the price of gold in US dollar terms is going to rise. But actually, it's your promise risk. Your problem is gold is pretty much the only asset, other than maybe silver, platinum, and palladium, that you actually own, and everything else comes with some kind of problem. If you own a stock, it requires exchange. It requires the government to maintain it. It requires regulators. It re requires clearing houses. If you own property, again, you need the law to enforce that your ownership of property. In a very uncertain world, owning physical gold that you can actually handle and touch and store yourself, there is no other asset like it. But your bigger problem, right, is it, say, we get to a point where we all want to cash out and we've made our money. Where can you put your money where it feels safe? I think this is the key problem. We put it in the stock market, we're at record highs. Is there going to be a crash in the future? I think, you know, when it comes, I don't know, but I don't, no one would disagree that a crash is going to come at some point. No, you put it in housing market, but again, real estate is at record highs. You can put it into cryptocurrency, but that's, you know, hugely volatile, and not everybody believes in, for example, the Bitcoin thesis. And so where can you go where you feel like you have total control? It's gold. And it's always been an inflationary hedge. I would caution this, though, that every bull market in precious metals has seen, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60% even drops on the way up. So if we saw 3,000 or 2,500 gold again, it would not surprise me in the next year or two before it resumes its march upwards. Or it might be different this time. It just keeps going up. We shall see.
Yeah, no one knows. And obviously, Rick also made the point that historically gold moves first and then silver only really starts to outperform when generalist investors come into the sector. I mean, I've seen on X, I've shared it, a few groups, people buy at the bullion, buying it, queuing around the block to get silver this week.
Yeah.
And silver has significantly outperformed gold, moving well beyond where most people thought it could go this quickly. And with 70 to 80% of all silver production being a byproduct of mining for the metals, you know, such as lead, zinc, copper, gold, there's no major capex cycle or infrastructure boom that is going to lead to any significant increase in the supply of these metals in the near future. Does it feel like it's a perfect storm, you know, a storm of soaring demand and stagnant supply? Is this, in your view, Charles, the classic silver phase of a precious metals bull market? And does that suggest we're seeing broader participation now, not just fear-driven buy-in?
Well, I think the silver market is different. It's different to gold. I mean, there's a few things to unpack here. The first thing is that, I mean, earlier in the year when gold was kind of rocketing, silver basically hadn't moved. You know, we had this conversation, either gold's going to fall back to its historical ratio with silver, or silver's going to rocket up to meet it. And we kind of all agreed silver would move up. Hence, we've all been buying silver over the past year. And then that thesis has proven correct. Your problem you have in the silver market is, like the gold market, but to a much greater degree, is the paper market for silver is ridiculous. You know, there's well over 100 contracts for every single ounce of physical silver. And so in the past, major banks have been able to repress the price of silver to a degree, you know, for important, you know, financial stability reasons, not for any kind of this. But now you have the case where people physically want the silver. They don't want to settle in dollars. They're taking the contracts in silver and gold, and they're saying, we actually want our silver and gold. And so you're seeing, you know, if you try and buy large quantities of silver or gold from central banks now, or the Royal Mint, for example, you'll find that you're going to be waiting a lot longer than you might have done a year or two ago, because this physical stuff doesn't exist. It's all just paper. And this is why the price of it is going up and up and up, in my mind anyway, because people are taking physical delivery of the metal, which they didn't in the past. I'm not sure how much longer that can continue before the system shuts it down in some way. In the same way as, I mean, a lot of the gold and silver, like Fresnillo shares that I own, I don't comment on them much because it's a major. So, you know, but I think they're up well over 300% year to date. Greatland obviously has done really well, partly because of the back of the rising gold price. A concern I have going into 2026, 2027, is if governments decide to tax those profits as windfall taxes, because you have Western nations dealing with tax issues. They want money. And what, you know, they've gone after the oil industry many times, but precious metals look like they're ripe for a picking. So fingers crossed they don't, but I can see that happening. So be careful with your jurisdictions, maybe would be a
20% VAT on gold next year, maybe?
Well, I think it's more that possibly, but I think it's more if you're like a major gold mine, like in Africa, for example, it happens all the time, right? Mm. A mine sets up, spends its capex, starts making a load of money, and then the taxes go up. But could we start seeing that happen in other jurisdictions where that historically hasn't? Mm. I think that's very possible. Yeah,
it's possible. And I mean, I think I've been taking every piece of information I can in the last few weeks on the silver situation. I just think there's so many different catalysts in terms of silver. Yeah. All the major banks have now basically come off their shorts that they've had for decades. They've all started to unravel them, and it's not quite finished yet, but that's, I think, the first stage. But what they've actually done is they've gone from shorting it now to gone long on it.
Long, yeah, stuff. Yeah.
So they've all been buying a huge amount of silver as well. So now they've gone from short and paper. I mean, the paper market is just a joke. The reality was, I think it was yesterday, checked that on the COMEX, it was 65, 89, and there was nearly backwardation as well going on, as in you could buy it cheaper in the futures market than you could on the spot, which is crazy. But in the Shanghai Exchange, which surprisingly enough is only physical, there's no paper trades at
Oh, I
all,
know.
it was $68.5.
And
So it was
it
already $3 ahead nearly of where it was in the paper. The paper's a joke. If somebody calls in, one of the reasons why we think it's gone up as much is somebody called in
a big
400
order.
400 million ounces of paper that they had, and they want physical delivery by December. That's half the world's production in one contract. There's something like, is it 300, no, 3 billion ounces on the paper, maybe more. 3 billion ounces on the paper, and there's only 800 million ounces every year being produced.
So the Hunt brothers in the 80s apparently tried to call, I don't remember this, obviously too young, but they apparently attempted to corner the silver market, and that's why they saw the spike from it was like $1.50 up to $50 an ounce. And I think we talked about this, Kev, adjusted for inflation, that was about 180 to $190
I
an
think it was
ounce.
over 200, but anyway,
Yeah, so
regardless,
if we say
it's a lot.
$200 in today's money, do you think that, with the current silver excitement, we could see it spike to those adjusted all-time highs?
I'm not sure it'll just spike. I think we're talking $150 to $200 silver in 1 to 2 years' time is going to be the norm. That's what it is. Because even that, if you take it back to the norms, whenever these spikes happened, again, I was listening to some podcasts on this, that whenever the spike happened in the 70s, the gold silver ratio went down to 1 to 15. Whenever it spiked, I think the next time the gold ratio went down to 1 to 30 or 1 to 32 or something like that. We're currently at 1 to 67. Okay, so if you do the maths on that, and even just say we go to 1 to 30 or 1 to 32, you are looking at $150 silver, and that's if gold stays where it is. Now, I perceive gold's going to move towards 6,000. So if it goes towards 6,000, 30 to 1 silver ratio is $180 silver. Now, the question again on everybody's lips, and you've been saying the same thing, is silver $180 or is the dollar just worth significantly less?
Or, and you have to be careful though, because these fucking bankers, excuse the swearing, they're gonna do something. I don't know what yet. I don't know what. But in the world of the GameStop and the turning off the buy button, they're gonna find a way to stop to play the market. And I'm not saying that your prediction is wrong, Kev, based on fundamentals, just that
It's not a
someone.
free market.
No, that's the best way of putting it. It's not a free market,
You
and
know,
they'll
it's.
figure it out. They'll do something. This is why I said $80, for silver at the end of next year potentially, simply because they'll find a way to keep a lid on it. And it might be something as simple as saying, right, the
But they kept
COMEX
a
isn't
lid on
doing
it around
delivery.
the 20 to 30 to 40 range for many years, but until they couldn't, that's the way it
Yeah,
felt anyway, you know.
but it's a narrative, right? Because you can say, oh, it's gone up to 80. That's your squeeze. And then whatever they do, whether it's turning off buy buttons or the COMEX is saying no more physical delivery.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just on to Kev's point about the buying power of the US dollar, onto the question we had for Rick was that he believed the purchasing power of the dollar could fall by as much as 75% over the next decade. And obviously, we haven't seen anything like that decline yet, but we've certainly seen persistent downward pressure on the dollar, rising debt levels, and markets increasingly pricing rate cuts rather than fiscal discipline, unless you're Donald Trump, who thinks the opposite. Would you say this year has been an early chapter in that story rather than the main event? And what would you be watching for as confirmation that the dishonest default, as Rick put it, is accelerating?
Well, the thing is, we're already down 10% on the dollar this year. So that's actually, right on track. I think one of the key things to understand about it, I did some research on this for one of my larger clients, is the macro, right, surrounding the US and Trump and potentially Hassett, the Fed shift, but also what's going on with Japan and the unwinding of the carry trade. On Friday, Japan's going to up their rates by 0.25%. That could be, very, very difficult. For the markets globally. But you have the system, right, where potentially if Scott Bessent remains Treasury Secretary while also leading the NEC, you'll have Hassett leading the Fed, and then fiscal, monetary, and tax policy all becomes coordinated together under a Trump axis. It's all meant to be independent, but that centralization of power, that hasn't been seen since Nixon ended dollar convertibility to gold, and the bond markets are starting to notice. Right, the inflation credibility, it is like the Nixon Burns era. The political pressure kept the rates really, really low. Inflation went to 12% in the US, and that ended up with the Volcker shock, and that all coincided with precious metals boom as well. And I think we're seeing the same here, because if you have a Trump appointed president in the Federal Reserve, and he's made extremely clear, you can even quote him, he said a requirement will be that they want to lower rates. Well, you're lowering rates into inflation.
You will have stagflation in the story.
And the worst thing is, right, for the UK, is that let's say you're Bailey at the Bank of England. We already have our own problems in that if we increase interest rates, then we destroy our economy's already struggling. So you can't really do that. And if you keep them the same, you have the same decline. And if you reduce them, as we have just done on a 5-4, the reason why it was so no one's quite sure what to do, you reduce them, you might get inflation back. But because the UK and the US are so interdependent on in forex terms, if the US is going to cut no matter what, we kind of have to as well. And if everybody's cutting interest rates into inflation, what happens when interest rates go down and inflation goes up? What happens to gold and silver? Well, the demand for them are going to go crazy because your fiat currency is starting to become worth less and less, and noticeably. And this is the key thing, right? It's noticeable now because over the past 12 months, for example, I think they say food inflation is what, 7% over the past 12 months. Now, if I went to Tesco, right, if I could get the prices of Tesco 12 months ago, but just plus 7% on average, I'd be extremely happy. But that's not the case. It's way more than that. We all know it is. So people are noticing more and more their fiat currency isn't holding up. You earn in pounds and dollars, it's not holding up against price rises.
Yeah, you got shrinkflation, not
And in shitification.
market.
And the worst thing is, in the UK, we have, beyond obviously like dividend tax increases and various other tax increases, but it's the fiscal drag. All of the tax bands are just staying static for the next decade. And so you might think, wow, I've got a pay rise and I've gone from 50 to 60 grand. Inflation's taken half of it away, and a third of it's gone to fiscal drag, and then you're only left off with a pound more. Oh no, my loaf of bread is 2 quid now. Like,
No,
anyway.
we've seen even a shrinkflation in Egypt as well, but mainly with the big brands. But you can see, like, your chocolate bar is smaller, your packet of whatever is smaller, your box of cornflakes is
Yeah,
smaller.
but price it in gold. Price it in gold, right?
Yeah.
Everything's gone down in price.
Yeah.
So,
Which tells you that gold is actually becoming more valuable in terms of what we're doing, but at the same time, so for me, it's not just that the dollar's
not
going
just the
down.
dollar, it's becoming inherently more valuable in and of itself as a store of
Yes,
value.
it's becoming inherently more valuable. So yeah, and it's not even that, isn't it? I mean, what Rick would have said to us on numerous times is that why would you want the metals? Well, you would want the metals basically to protect the real buying power of your portfolio of whatever it happens to be. Now, the next question is, can that be done in just physical gold, or should we have access to the miners, the producers, the explorers? You
And
know,
this is
some of the
it's
stuff I've heard is that, I mean, again, we're talking about Rick. Rick was very much, he made his money on the explorers, and yet now he preaches, you know, you want the highest quality and you want this and you want that. But actually, really, for me, I want the most exposure to explorers and the smaller size producers, because I think they've got the biggest potential to have huge increase in their EBITDAs in terms of what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to bear in mind that A, Rick is older, but also it's slippage risk, right? If Rick goes in and buys 5 million quid's worth of, small Explorer or Junior Co or whatever, he moves that share price up himself, and then he also can't get that money out. So he's operating on a completely different scale than we are. But
Well, in a lot of the explorers, you'd buy the whole explorer.
Yeah, no, you would. Yeah. And fund it as well. Do you know, I would say like a hot stock tip, if you like explorers for next year, and it's already done relatively well, it's up sort of 40% year to date, is Capital Drilling, which would, it does all the drilling services, or a load of drilling services, and it's London listed. If you think exploration is going to take off, and I do, I mean, I had a conversation with a couple of fund managers yesterday, actually, and we were talking about how all of the major gold and silver producers, like Newmont or Agnico Eagle or Fresnillo, they're all sitting on billions of dollars of free cash flow, right? And so they're all merging to do something with that money, and then they're getting rid of all their kind of sub tier one assets, which are still tier one but not tier one enough for them, like Telfer and Havieron, for example. But they still have loads and loads of money, and the choices are to give it back in a dividend, which hurts the stock price, and they don't like doing that, or they can go spend it. And one of the things they've underspent on over the past few decades is exploration. So that's where a lot of that money will eventually go. They'll turn on the taps because they'll go, well, the choices are we spend this money or we give it back to our investors. And if there's one thing I know about a major, they ain't like giving money back to investors. So they want to spend it.
No, but they also need to replace all these ounces
Of
and tons that
mines.
they're digging out the
They need
ground.
new discoveries. They need new discoveries. And the argument always was, well, we can't spend loads of money going on discoveries. We don't have that much money. And we want to maintain our, 7% dividend or whatever. Well, now you do have that much money. I mean, in my mind, this is your windfall that you need to invest for your next few decades. And the smart majors who do invest in exploration and come with new discoveries will do extremely well. And the ones that don't do that are going to be forced to buy tier two assets at some point in the next 10 to 20 years and develop them.
Well, I think it's
Anything
inevitable
else?
that they're gonna it's inevitable that they're gonna have to buy a tier two asset, which sounds terrible, but actually they're very, very good. They're just not gonna make billions and billions and billions of dollars from it, but they're gonna make hundreds of millions from it.
Well, they might do, because if there's no metal and the demand for metal keeps rising, then
Well,
they
that's
might be
true.
quite happy with that as well. But we shall see. We shall see.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, last time Rick was on, he offered a pretty stark warning saying that around 90% of the junior mining companies are effectively valueless, even if their share price rises. And since then, we have seen a lot of these stocks moving sharply higher without any real improvement in any fundamentals. So, has anything you've seen this year, Charles, made you more comfortable with speculation, or does it reinforce your view that most investors confuse the rising prices with rising value?
I mean, ironically, my explorers this year are my two losers in the portfolio. So, but they are higher risk, and the problem is that if you go swanning around in the DRC or bloody Zambia looking for copper or tin or whatever it is, there's political risk, there's geological risk. Often you go drilling, we've spoken to Colin many times. Sometimes he comes back with an RNS and, like the Silver King grades that we got, and you go, wow, those are amazing. And other times he comes out of something and you thought it'd be good and it just wasn't. But that's the nature of exploration, right? You're either going to hit big, find something massive and sell it for hundreds of millions, or you're not. And I think a lot of the share price movements are just sentiment. A really good example of this is Wishbone, and because that did a 20x close to Telfer earlier in the year, and then it's come down quite a lot, but it's still probably up significantly year to date, and we don't have the says from it yet. We've got sort of initial indications and breccia pipes and whatever like buzzwords you want to use, but there's no assays come out of that project.
Yeah, we don't really know, do
You
we?
don't know.
That's
It could
the
be
reality.
incredible. It could be incredible, but it could also be, worthless, and
Yeah,
you don't know.
could be crap. That's right. But if you look at Colin and what he's actually doing with all of his companies, if you look at Extract, they're going to be producing in 2026 now. So he's realized to create the value, you're going to have to create revenue. The same in Bazant now. It's going to be a copper, gold, silver mine. In 2026, they're going to be creating revenue. I don't think African Pioneer is a million miles behind it. You're going to have Galileo, which has now got that 23% of the Jubilee asset, and they're going to be creating revenue because they're going to be producing copper in 2026 as well. So I see that what happened a few years ago, when a lot of them were able to raise money during the casino time, they have deployed that money quite wisely, and they're now coming to the point where the assets that they have, they can now actually take some to production. So I think what Rick is saying, I don't want to say that he's wrong, but I think it's not 90% anymore. I think it's more like 60% are no good, 40% have the possibility with these metal prices to actually achieve something.
Yeah, I think what you need to hit to be commercially viable is very different now than it was 2 or 3 years ago. But
So last question from me really is, you know, Rick talked about removing downside first, then letting upside look after itself. In this environment, is patience now a bigger edge than boldness?
I'm all for patience, always have been. I mean, my portfolio across the 15 stocks that I picked at the start of the year is up somewhere in the region of 70% across 2025, right? In that portfolio, there are stocks like Sovereign, for example, which is down 20%, but is up over the past few years. Amarok, which is, you know, a few percent down, but again, up over the past few years. Then you have Explorers, you know, which are down significantly, but if they find something, then it's great. I think this kind of, particularly on the AIM market or in the small cap market, where when you buy stocks, the spread between the bid and the ask can be so large. If you're buying in size, then you just need to be buying to be holding them because you believe in the assets and in the management. And then, you know, often it's the case that you do that. Not even often, sometimes, and they fail. But the idea is that your winners beat out the losers. At the same time, I will say, if a theme or a trend comes along, like the Bitcoin treasury companies earlier in the year, where it's very clear there's euphoria going on, trade, make some profit, take some money on the way up. You know, as I said at the time, this is basically gambling. One or two companies will win that space at some point in the next few years. But, you know, don't fall in love with it when that kind of theme comes. And they do just come and go, and we do get one every year or two.
Okay. Cheers for that. Great to get your insights. So we've got a really special segment now with a person whose career sits right at the very top of automotive engineering and specialist car manufacturing. We're joined by John Miner, CEO of Nichols Cars, who has built a career leading high-end automotive and engineering businesses. John has been instrumental in turning Nichols from a pure engineering vision into a functioning manufacturer, overseeing the commercial strategy, production planning and brand development behind the N1A, and positioning Nichols Cars as a modern engineering-led marque rooted in genuine motorsport heritage. We'll be launching a dedicated Nichols Cars podcast series going into 2026, powered by Velocity Club, where we'll be joined not just by engineers and designers, but also by figures from across motorsport, racing drivers, team principals, and leading motoring journalists, diving deep into the stories, the engineering decisions, and the culture behind some of the most interesting cars ever built. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you very much, Phil. Thanks.
Absolutely. So, John, just tell us a little bit about your background. You know, what drew you personally into the world of specialist performance cars, and how did that journey lead you to Nichols Cars?
Well, I've been a car nut for as long as I can remember, and I grew up in a place called Downer Market. My dad was very friendly with a chap called Jim Russell, who was just starting his driving school at the time. My uncle was in partnership in a place called Biggleswade with a bloke called John Trigero, who was responsible for the Cobras for people like John Wolfe. And as far back as I can remember, I was a car nut. And I had the ability, I started off on the technical side of an advertising business, doing technical writing and promoting technical products. And I had a client that was a CAD-CAM supplier. They were the first CAD-CAM company to be involved in Formula One, supplying Williams back in the 80s. And I became sort of friendly with the people at Williams, and I had a good relationship because I could understand what they were trying to do and how to best use them with the equipment that they were being given. And then once you have a sort of foot in, you have credibility, and that enables you to move elsewhere. So I sort of switched from marketing more into project management, working with people like John Barnard for a number of Formula One teams. I did quite a bit. Well, I mean, it was a fairly obscure project, but there was a team called Super Aguri, which was created to provide a drive for a Honda driver that they wanted to shift away from the Honda Works team. And we had a Christmas, the week before Christmas, there was a flat table with an old Arrow chassis stuck on it, and then a a gap, and then a Honda engine, which wasn't meant to be designed to fit that chassis, and then an Arrows gearbox behind the Honda engine, and people walking around it scratching their heads. And we had the car running in about 6 weeks, and that, you know, was good fun. I mean, very intensive, but really fulfilling. And one of the funny things about it was in the first 6 months of that season, it was the most reliable car on the grid. And when you knew how many bodges there were to make it all fit together, it was quite remarkable. Yeah, and then I also works on the road car side for people like Lamborghini, Brabus, and so on. So yeah, that's me basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously people who are in, who know the sort of car industry and also, I guess, Formula One technology will know the name Nichols, based on obviously Steve Nichols, who's one of the most influential Formula One designers of his era. He was obviously chief designer at McLaren during its most dominant period in the 1980s, playing a central role in the championship winning cars such as the MP44, which secured multiple drivers and constructors titles with legends like Alain Prost and Ayrton Senna. And his work obviously helped define ground effect aerodynamics and carbon fiber design at the very highest level of motorsport. DNA that obviously we still see and now carries into directly into the Nichols N1A car. So just talk us through your, presumably your friendship with Steve, and how the N1A, the Nichols car, was born. In terms of, from what I can gather, it was very much, let's build a track car, and then it sort of escalated pretty quickly from there.
Well, yeah, I've known Steve for about 20 years, and he's a petrolhead as well. So we would quite often talk about what sort of things we would like to do. And in a moment of madness, quite a few years ago, we thought we might have a go at buying TVR. And we got a good merchant bank behind us and everything ready to go. And we were at the diligence phase, and it kept on throwing up all sorts of questions. And to cut a long story short, the owner, Nicholas Smolensky, thought we were wasting his time and decided that he didn't want to sell it to us. And he made the statement that there wasn't going to be a TVR anymore. So for a little while, we thought about doing a TVR-type product, because I was being assured by a number in the old TVR dealer network that there was definitely a market for such a car. So we looked at doing a TVR-type car with a different brand. And one of the brands that we looked at was Elva. And Elva doesn't really mean, or certainly then didn't mean an awful lot to most enthusiasts, but it was the brand that the very first McLarens were marketed under. And I thought that there was a good backstory to it, and that one way of reintroducing Elva would be to do a modern take on the M1A. And that was an idea that I'd had a while before. I thought it was a great looking car. It was back in the days when, before ground effect and downforce and so on, when cars were designed by eye to look nice. And I think, I don't know if it's true, but I'd heard that the M1A was actually designed by Michael Turner, the motorsport artist. So but it was a lovely looking car. And I'd seen another car by a designer called Jason Castriata called the Ferrari P45, which was a modernized version of a Ferrari 330 P4. And I thought that doing something similar with an M1A would work really well. So that was always on an idea. And then the TVR was sold to Les Edgar, and they made, you know, sort of convincing sounds that they were going to go back into production and that there was going to be a TVR. So doing a TVR type without the brand wasn't going to be viable, but it looked like the N1 would be a good idea. So we carried on talking about that, and it got to the point where we thought, well, rather than just talk about it, let's build one and see what it looks like and see how it works. So we did a fairly crude black prototype originally, which we mulled some of the suspension, some of the drivetrain, but most importantly of all, the first sort of attempt at a body for it. And it was incredibly well received. We'd get people coming up to us saying, oh, what a fantastic looking car, and so on. So it clearly had some potential. It was always the intention that it would be road usable. So it is obviously focused to be a very, very fast car that you can use on the track. But I've done, you know, thousands of miles in various prototypes, and it's really nice on a Sunday afternoon and just sort of waffling along, you know, 1500 revs or whatever, just sort of
something you can take to the pub on a Sunday almost.
It is, yeah, it is, and it has been done, yes.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm just actually looking, John, at the M1A, actually, which, as you say, was the team's first self-designed and developed sports car. And having seen the N1A at Thruxton when you came along in, you know, sort of October, I can see a lot of similarities on there. Obviously, you know, I think it raced in the North American Can-Am series in the 1966 season, but it is very similar. How true to the original would the N1A be compared to the M1A?
It's very, very different. We haven't taken a photograph of the two side by side, but it is wider and more aggressive, longer wheelbase. You know, everything on it is different, but there are nods to the original design language. So, I mean, I was really surprised when I first started doing research to find out that the dimension on an M1A, all the dimensions were lower than a Lotus Elise. So the wheelbase was shorter, it was narrower. The only thing that was longer was the nose overhang, but everything else was smaller. So it was a really small, really tiny car. And so, yeah, it is very different.
Yeah.
And then under the skin, it uses modern technology everywhere. So the chassis is bonded aluminium with carbon fiber. It's got carbon brakes, you know, 7-liter engine, which is sort of twice the capacity of the M1A came out with originally. Yeah, so it's a nod to that era, but it is a very different car.
Yeah, and what have been some of the biggest challenges in turning that sort of engineering vision into a real road legal manufacturable car? You know, earlier on, just preamble, we were talking about some of the legislation that's been put in. You know, or there's a lot of governance that you need to meet in terms of design. Has there been any challenges starting from a car, you know, car from the ground up?
No, I mean, not in those areas. There are fairly accommodating regulations for very low volume manufacturing. So in the UK, for example, we have to go through a thing called IVA, which is individual vehicle approval. And that is like a sort of an extended MOT. There are, on top of that, there are regulations regarding lighting, height of lights, radiuses of edges in the cockpit for crash protection and so on. But generally, it's pretty well defined, and that isn't the problem. The challenge is really is that everything takes longer than you think it's going to, and it costs more than you think it's going to. And so, yeah, that's it, basically.
Yeah. And production, from what I can gather, of the M1A will be limited to about 100 units, although the run will begin with 15 special edition cars, which I believe is one for each of the MP44's wins in 1988. So a real nod to that MP44 car. Just talk us through that. Is that the right information we've got?
That is correct, yeah. So the limited run is to a very high specification. So there is an options list, and it basically ticks all the options on that. And they are individually numbered, and they have plaques denoting the victory that they are celebrating.
Excellent. And just looking ahead, do you see Nichols as a one-car story, or is it the foundation for a longer-term range and maybe legacy?
No, there is definitely there are plans for further vehicles along the track, and you know, we've got a fantastic chassis which is working beautifully, and it really lends itself to extending the range a bit. But you know, we're not talking imminently. I mean, we want to get the first cars built now and out the door.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we look forward to sitting down with you next year and, you know, really diving deeper into your background, learning more about Nichols and the M1A, and welcoming you know, other interesting guests onto the show. So wishing you a Merry Christmas and prosperous New Year, John. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thanks, Phil. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
No worries.
Thanks, John. I didn't understand any of it, but thanks a lot.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. Best performer this week, and you can shed some light on this, Charles, is Arc Minerals, up some 75% on the week. It seems like, unless I can't find any significant news that's driving that one right
now. Well, it is, I believe it is publicly
That's a perfect Rick scenario here.
Yeah, it is.
Leading well in on Rick's.
I mean, the thing is, Anglo left the joint venture. The company does have cash in it, you know. But I think it is kind of well known at this point that the key court case is being heard on the 22nd of December. So from where we're recording, a few days in the future. And I imagine people are just positioning for that result. It's as simple as that. Whichever way it settles, positively or negatively, will hugely affect the share price. But you look at sort of the trajectory over the past few years, obviously it's down significantly. Should ARC retain the license?
If ARC have given the appropriate brown envelopes, they will win.
I can't say that, can I? But it's not even appropriate. It's Zambia, isn't it? It's not even appropriate brown envelopes. It's more to retain your licenses.
Well, white envelopes.
You got to fight for them. You got to fight for your licenses constantly. But it's the court case is being resolved. It's as simple as that.
Okay, moving on. Sovereign Metals up 25%. You spoke to Sapan, both of you, early in the week. What are your thoughts on that? You did describe it as a game change in RNS.
Well, we recorded a podcast a few days ago. We were saying, oh, no, it's down year today. I was like, oh, it might end up the year blue. It's, you know, Aguero right at the end of the year. But, yeah, do you know, it's the World Bank. It basically means this thing's going to get built. It's as simple as that.
Do you think it's de-risked the project?
It's politically de-risked massively because the new government coming in was a bit of a concern. But now they're walking into the president's office with the World Bank that's funding pretty much all of the infrastructure in Malawi. On their side, and the bank wants to get it built, and whether it's Sovereign who's going to do the building or they're going to sell it to Rio Tinto or another major company makes sense to me now.
Ultimately, the tax take that Malawi will get from this could change the country.
Oh, 100%, 100%, and they've put their sort of it's not just the tax take though, Kev. There's not very much mining in Malawi at the moment at all. I mean, Sovereign have to build up the expertise themselves. If you get this one massive major mine going right smack bang on the Nacala corridor, then all of the other projects like Mkango's, you know, Somewhere Rare Earths, or like the various other mines that they want to get built out there, you build up the expertise. And then it springboards to build up the mining sector in general. So it's not just this one project, it's for dozens of others. So they are highly incentivized the government to get it done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Polarian Imaging down some 45% on the news that they're following the approval at the general meeting. The admission of the shares to trading on AIM was going to be cancelled. So that one's will be delisted. Yeah. So news on that one on Polarian. It's still trading as of Thursday evening. It's currently on the market. But there was also news, as you said, Kev, that Valerium was suspended in the week because the corporate advisor on Aquis resigned.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it, to be honest with you, but I was speaking to Gary about 10 days ago, and it was a bit of a shock to me because they're still progressing. I did say in the statement that they're still progressing this big corporate deal. So if that happens, it's $200 million basically on their balance sheet, and it would be an absolute game changer. So I don't know what's happened, but anyway.
Okay, and then Defence Holdings, Charles, down some 32% on the week. I mean, again, it's something we've talked about in the past, a company. I think people were probably expecting a little bit of news flow, maybe on some contracts coming in December. But where are we on this one?
Well, it's a growth stock, right? If it bounces up, it bounces down. If you go up 100% in one day, then great. If it goes down 30, 40% in a week, then that's just the name of the game. If you look at any other successful growth stock, it's done similar trajectories. And it doesn't mean that it's guaranteed to be successful because you know, growth stocks are risky.
You tell the people in the Telegram group who keep moaning about it.
Well, as I said at the very start, and I continue to say, invest what you're comfortable with and then just sit back. You know, the products that are being developed are being developed by some of the best minds in the business, you know, in partnership with the MOD, with Google, right? On air gap cloud platforms. If you're stressing out about the share price bouncing up and down, then you've got probably overinvested. I do think that once you get that first contract, which I do think will be coming relatively soon, then it will re-rate and the nerves will settle. But it's also just the case that, you know, people in this market fall in love with the story. The story is amazing, but just be careful with portfolio risk and diversification. Sure. As I say, all of our, you know, if you look at all of our personal picks throughout the year, overall between us, we've done extremely well and individually. But some of our picks have not gone well. So diversify.
That's an understatement. The second bit. The one piece of news that came on Thursday was that Mr. Trump has decided in his wisdom to go, and let me just read it. As part of the agreement, Trump Media will provide up to $200 million in cash to TAE at signing, with an additional $100 million available upon initial filing on the Form S-4 registration statement. The combined company plans to begin construction of what it describes as the world's first utility-scale fusion power plant in 2026, with a capacity of 50 megawatts electricity, subject to required approvals. Additional plants of 350 to 500 megawatts are also planned. Holy crap, in terms of Guardian Metal Resources. Now he needs tons and thousands of tons of tungsten. Where's he going to get it from?
Do you honestly believe he can get an actual performing, you know, an actual fusion reactor built in a year?
Well, this is
he's the US president. He's got money. So
we're talking we're talking 10 to 20 years away from getting and actually harnessing and being able to contain it and run it reliably.
That's not what TAE is saying.
You have artificial intelligence now, which you didn't have before. So you can speed run it so much faster than you ever could in the past. Another fusion related story, which a lot of people have missed, a very sad story, but yesterday, the head of fusion labs at MIT in the US was shot dead. Right.
What?
So Nuno Lucero, he's helping develop clean energy fusion devices. And, you know, I'm no conspiracy theorist, but it seemed he made a breakthrough and he was shot.
Let me read the bottom of this, okay? TAE Technologies, founded in 1998. So they've been trying to do this for 27 years. Has raised more than $1.3 billion in private capital from Google, Chevron, Technology Ventures, Goldman Sachs, and Sumitomo Corporation of America. The company has built and operated 5 fusion reactors already.
If you crack fusion, you have virtually unlimited clean energy.
Yeah.
So whoever does it will put oil out of business.
Yeah, it's a bit like the guy who invented the hydrogen powered car back in the day, and he was bombed. He died in suspicious circumstances too. So I you don't know. I mean, it's the conspiracy theory.
But the point I'm trying to make is, tungsten went over $1,000. I don't even know what the terminology is because it's not per ton. $1,000 in China a couple of days ago. Now Trump has just put all his eggs in the fusion basket, and they need tungsten in the USA. What is that going to do to Guardian Metal Resources?
I imagine pretty good. I mean, tungsten's up nearly 300% year to date in China. If you want to buy the physical stuff, they're not exporting any of it. And the US needs it for fusion, for defense, for everything.
And GMET's going on to the New York Stock Exchange in probably February.
And keep your eye out on Greatland as well, because they've got a massive wedge of tungsten. And I'll bet my bottom dollar the US wants some of it. So, but okay, you're going to need more than one.
Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast, Charles. Great to have you, and have a great Christmas.
Yep, happy Christmas, gents.
Okay, if you enjoyed the chat and want to stay in the loop, definitely hit the subscribe and tap that bell icon so you never miss an update. We really appreciate you being here, and we'll catch you next time for more news and stories. Have a great Christmas all, and thanks for listening, and have a fantastic Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.